Chapter 12. First Signs. Rust and Rest. The Fallen Tower. Borne aloft by surges of emotion and swells of turbulent consciousnesses, Amon soared on the tides of the great ocean.
"This is life as it ought to be experienced,"
cried Magnus, spiraling above him.
"Free of physical constraints and limited only by our imagination."
Joy surged through Amon as he and Magnus blazed through the immaterium like shooting stars. No shattered spine held Amon in a realm where physical laws were meaningless. Here, there was no good and evil, right or wrong. The searing trail they left was the brightest beacon, drawing warp creatures of every configuration, from the raptor flocks of atavistic scrap feeders to titanic leviathans whose mere existence defied human contemplation. And yet they flew unmolested. Even broken, Magnus was known to the denizens of the great ocean, and none dared trouble him. The brazen entities of purest rage turned away as well, their blunted survival instincts recognizing a destroyer when they sensed one. Amon kept close to his father, terrified and enthralled at the risks they took in flying so brightly. The warp entities might fear Magnus, but Amon was nothing to them. Stray too far, and he would be on his own. His subtle body was wrought from the stuff of dreams into his idealized form of his imagined self, armor gleaming like translucent crystal, vivid red and molten gold.
"Come, Amon!"
cried Magnus, spinning to shed corkscrewing comets of inspiration.
"Cast off that echoed aspect. Be whatever you wish, a god in mortal form, a winged spirit or a glittering dragon of fire."
A twist of thought, and Amon became a blaze of coruscating energy, an ultra-dense helix of spinning wheels and eyes, chains of thought more elegant than anything conceived by the greatest mortal philosophers. It made him beautiful, and his tears of joy became newborn stars in the warp's firmament. Magnus flew as a glittering phoenix, with wings of blazing amber, starfire eyes, and the heart of a supernova. His power and intellect were as one, and he soared on etheric winds to blaze a trail of light as he went. Where it bled into the material realm, it gifted wondrous dreams to receptive minds. They flew far from the planet of the sorcerers, towards what Magnus had called the Orrery, travelling beyond the limits of space and time, achieving in a breath what was impossible for all but a handful of gifted individuals. They penetrated the hearts of warped storms of sorrowed beauty, skirted the petulant darkness of Lorgar's ruin storm, and crested slow-blooming maelstroms of gathering hope. Randomness was everywhere, and Amon sought to find meaning in the patterns. The great ocean responded to his desire by reshaping itself, tapestries of memory woven from the fabric of things forgotten, things remembered, and things impossible. Amid the chaos of the great ocean, they followed geometric configurations, clues in cosmic alignments and multidimensional arrays of perfect synchrony, confluences of intersecting realities and auspicious convergences presented themselves, and the temptation to follow each to its ending was overwhelming. The sheer thrill of exploring the farthest reaches of the great ocean at his father's side was an intoxicating reminder of glories once thought quotidian. Imperial worlds whose atmospheres were rich in meaning, where every volume contained within Borgus's theoretical library might be stored. Then there were the worlds of fractal complexity, upon which every pen scratch since the dawn of time could be recorded. Amon saw a newborn galaxy, where the secrets of Akasha were carried on the wavelengths of its starlight and basked in its radiant illumination. But in the end, Magnus had only one place in mind to become the Orrery, somewhere the limitless potential of the great ocean could alloy with the material universe, where a metaphorical sea of dreams could be made real, a world veiled from sight by alignments of galaxies, and which Magnus would secure with celestial locks that would only open when the stars aligned.
"Such beauty makes it all too easy to forget that the War Master has torn the galaxy in two,"
said Amon, as they paused to admire what Magnus had found. Thoughts of war seem so far away. And the vastness of the Immaterium has that effect, agreed Magnus. It makes mortal affairs pale to insignificance. If such affairs do not matter in the grand tapestry of existence, why then do we endure so much pain and suffering to alter them? Said Amon. What grand deed has ever caused the slightest ripple in the universe when seen from so lofty a cosmic perspective? Magnus extended his burning wings and soared towards an unfolding conflagration of energies, a radiant nebula of screaming emotions shaped by some unseen catastrophe in the material universe. We are all bound by the better angels of our natures, Amon. None of us can afford to be neutral while the great battle of our time unfolds. Our brothers tear at one another with hatred, only made possible by the corruption of love. And could we live with ourselves if we did not try to lessen that horror? Even if we cannot affect the outcome? Who says I cannot? Said Magnus. One might call such a belief egotistical. Then let me ask you this. Imagine you alone had guarded Prospero's shores when the wolves came. Would you have stood aside, knowing you had no hope of altering the outcome of the battle? Would you have given up? No, I would have fought. And that is why I act. For all that we are condemned, for all that our names and deeds will be blackened from now until the stars go out, I have always sought to act with honour, Utizar. With pride, yes, but always with... Magnus paused, and Amon felt a tremor ripple out through the warp. The creatures of the warp felt it too, and fixed hungry eyes upon them. My lord, is something wrong? Magnus's image flickered, his blazing wings guttering and dying as his mortal form resolved itself amid the fading fire. The Crimson King Amon had last seen atop the obsidian tower was gone, and the being before him was a shadow of that mighty warrior lord. The cost of this flight in the great ocean was proving far greater than Amon had feared. Among the many dangers of the great ocean were seductions that drew travellers farther from their bodies than was safe, and, like neophytes on their first flight, Magnus and Amon had gone deeper than ever to find what they sought. Hostile things uncoiled in the darkness, sensing unexpected opportunity, and gathering like carrion around a fresh corpse.
Balak, said Magnus,
uncertainty giving his words a brittle edge.
Balak Utizar, is that you? Your aura is different.
No, my lord, it is Amon.
Amon of the Corvidae. Why are you here? I summoned Balak to attend upon me.
Amon hesitated before answering, seeing dreadful uncertainty enter the Primarch's aura like a poison. It formed turbulent swells and swirling ether vortices around them, the early signs of a gathering storm.
Balak is not here, my lord, he said. He died.
Died? What are you talking about? Balak is not dead.
I spoke with him just this morning in the reflecting caves.
No, my lord, said Amon, the sight of his father's confusion like a knife to the heart. That Amon was utterly helpless against this insidious and unreachable foe was crushing.
You did not.
Magnus's fractured state spread agitation through the warp like blood spilt into water. Though Amon suspected the Primarch's splintered soul might suffer further degeneration in the warp, the hope of its restoration seemed worth the risk.
Of course I did, said Magnus. Amon? Is that you?
Yes, my lord, said Amon, and the fear in his father's aura made him weep. We need to return to the Obsidian Tower.
The Obsidian Tower? I know of no such place, snapped Magnus.
You speak in riddles, Amon.
In the Emperor's name, tell me why Utizar is not here.
Amon could not bring himself to reveal the truth of what had befallen Balak Utizar, could not hurt his father by telling him it had been his own power that killed the Athenian telepath after he had seen his father's thoughts. That truth would bring the predatory warp beasts down on them without mercy.
We return to Prospero,
declared Magnus. And then we will get to the bottom of your lies, Amon.
My lord, I do not lie, and we cannot return to Prospero.
Why not? A lie would not serve. Only the truth, and the things in the dark bared immaterial fangs like knives being sharpened. Prospero is no more. The wolves burned it to ash. A burst of grief exploded from Magnus, a primal venting of emotion that bore an unimaginable weight of guilty knowledge. It set the warp aflame in every direction, and millions of mortal nightmares were born on tens of thousands of worlds. Amon screamed as the warp fire burned his subtle body, his Primarch's fears and secrets like hot brands upon his soul. The flames incinerated his armor, leaving his body of light horribly vulnerable. His mind fled to the higher enumerations, throwing up instinctual defenses and detaching his screaming consciousness from repercussive sensations. With the pain under control, Amon's warp sight pierced the psychic conflagration Magnus had unleashed. The Crimson King had vanished. Amon was utterly alone, and the things in the darkness fell upon him. Peace of a sort had fallen on Committee Sona. The battle was over, and the tally of the dead was being made. Yasu Nagasena stood alone in the ruins of the main gallery, surrounded by blackened corpses of its former inmates. The Vorax swept the chamber, searching for signs of life, ending any who still had breath in their lungs. The reek of burning bodies clung to him like a shroud. The Thousand Suns were gone, borne away on the back of the monstrous god machine. But what had become of them was yet a mystery. A storm of witchery prevented any immediate pursuit, but Araxei and his Ursarax were even now sweeping the upper levels of the prison for signs of the red sorcerers. Nagasena stood over the first man he had killed this day. He dropped to his knees like a devotee in a fane, ready to prostrate himself before his god. He grunted in pain. His side was a fiery mass of bruising and cracked ribs, but that was a small price to pay for his life. The beautiful swordsman with the likeness of the Primarch Fulgrim had thrown him contemptuously from the upper gallery, but a leaping Ursarax caught him and bore him to the ground. Nagasena had lived, but Shujiki had not. He lifted the broken sword, its blade ending in a clean break a handspan from the circular guard. Lifting it to his lips, he kissed the length of gleaming steel before turning and ramming it into the corpse.
"Your name is Shujiki, which means honesty," he said, bowing to the embedded blade. "You are my virtue and my burden. You saved my soul and my life. For this, I thank you."
Nagasena clasped his hands before him, letting the sounds of burning corpses and the crackle of flames wash over him.
"Before you came to me, I was a fool and a braggart, a man of flawed morals and wicked temperament. But when Master Nagamitsu united us, your truth became part of me. I have never spoken falsely or dishonored your name since."
Nagasena lifted his head and sang softly in the tongue of his homeland, the words lilting.
"Broken blade, lie you there, deep buried in a vanquished foe. As I draw new steel from sheath, look you now on a setting sun. Sharp shearer on this field of death, your time of rust and rest is here. Now repose, my lightning blade, who raised kings and cast them down. Brother of my worthless hand, farewell, truth-bearing sword."
With the words spoken, Nagasena felt another piece unravel from his soul, a lock placed around the wickedness of his old life crumble to dust. The oath he'd laid upon Shujiki's blade had been his anchor, his moral compass when such things were the most prized gifts of all. He felt the presence of someone standing behind him, someone with sense enough not to interrupt his ritual. From the warning hackles rising on his neck, he knew it to be Bodvar Biaki. Nagasena stood in one fluid motion, turning on his heel and leaving Shujiki embedded in the corpse. The rune priest cast his gaze around the carnage with the dispassionate eye of a man utterly unfazed by such bloodletting.
Can you repair it?
Asked Bjarki, nodding towards the broken sword.
Can you bring your fallen brother back to life?
Snapped Nagasena, instantly regretting it. Bjarki bared his fangs, and but for the authority Nagasena carried, he would already be dead for speaking such thoughtless words.
I can't, said Bjarki. But a weapon is not alive. Forgive me, Bodvar, said Nagasena,
clasping his hands before him.
Grief makes me speak without thinking. I just thought you would understand what Shujiki meant to me. That blade was the work of a master, agreed Bjarki,
placing a giant hand on Nagasena's shoulder.
Forged with craft and heart from the sharpest steel and dragon's breath. And I know exactly what it was to you. But even so, such things can be remade.
Not Shujiki, said Nagasena.
Maybe not, said Bjarki. Just do not mistake the blade for the man. One can break, but the other will endure.
I hope you are right, my friend.
That is for the weird to know, said Bjarki, turning away.
I am sorry for the loss of Har Balagir, said Dagasena.
Bjarki paused and nodded without turning back.
It was his time, he said with a fatalistic shrug. We will give him his sending when we are far from this place.
Sending?
A farewell of sorts, as you gave to your blade, said Bjarki. He should be returned to Fenris. But if our threads do not lead back to Azaheim, then somewhere with an ocean will do. His tribe were Vatyup, hunters of the many armed ones of the Vatadak. Ha should go down into the ocean.
May I be present for his sending?
Bjarki looked back over his shoulder.
No,
he said, striding away.
Come.
Nagasena followed the rune priest.
Have you received any word from Sister Caesarea?
He asked.
No, which is bad. But she is not our responsibility.
The space wolves were gathered around a pyre of burning bodies. Thick smoke hid the worst of their deformities, but not enough to make it easy to look upon them. The pack turned at their approach. Their yellow eyes were sullen and hostile with suppressed aggression.
Let me kill this one,
said Svavnir Rackwolf, before Bjarki could speak.
He needs to walk with Har Balagir's shade. A warrior should know the reason why the weird cuts his thread.
Nagasena looked past Rackwolf to where Olgir Widowson held the chain leash of a painfully thin man of Nordafrik, whose legs were clearly broken in several places. He clutched a chipped ceramic urn to his chest with his one remaining arm, and the lower half of his skull was enclosed by a Brank's bridle of knotted leather. His eyes were wide with terror at the sight of the wolf pack, and Nagasena knew exactly why.
Lemuel Garmon,
he said, and the man looked at him with a pleading look of desperate hope. The remembrance's face, as familiar to Nagasena as his own after so long spent studying his records. 5 years in committee Sona had aged him thrice that, and melted the fat from his previously rotund frame. Nagasena knelt beside Lemuel, and reached up to unbuckle the mask, gagging the man.
That is not wise, said Bjarki. You said this man was Araman's apprentice. He is likely Maleficarum.
Oh, we can't question him if he is gagged.
Bjarki grinned.
I can rip the truth out of him without needing to hear corrupt words,
he promised, and the man whimpered in fear, struggling to push himself away, even over the agony of two shattered legs.
I must, Bodvar, said Nagasena.
Bjarki shrugged and took the chain leash from Widowson. He yanked Lemuel's face upwards.
We will remove the Brank remembrance, sir, he said. But know this. You die if I smell even a fart of sorcery from you.
Lemuel nodded, and Bjarki dropped the chain. The splintered ends of broken bones in Lemuel's legs ground together, and he cried out in muffled pain through the mask. Nagasena looked Lemuel straight in the eye.
My name is Yasu Nagasena, he said. I am going to remove this device so you can answer my questions. Speak truthfully, and your injuries will be healed. But you should know it will be extremely dangerous to lie. Nod if you understand what I have said.
Lemuel did so, and Nagasena carefully unbuckled the straps holding the leatherwork brank in place. Lemuel sucked in a juddering breath as it was pulled clear, eyes wide with pain, skin slick with fear.
They took Camille,
he said, the words coming out in a rush.
Please, you have to get her back. And Shire, she's in one of the upper cells. The servitor thing, it hit her. Maybe it killed her, I don't know. Please, can you look? Help her.
Nagasena held up a hand and Lemuel's babble ceased.
The Thousand Sons took Mistress Shivani.
Yes.
And Mahavastu Kalimakas? They took him too?
Lemuel's eyes flicked warily towards Biaki, and Nagasena saw his terror of giving an answer that might see him killed.
No.
They did not take him.
He was never here.
Nagasena rocked back onto his haunches, processing this new information. He looked up at Biaki, then returned his attention to Lemuel.
These are the facts as I understand them, he said. You, Mistress Shivani, and Mahavastu Kalimakas were aboard the Cypria Selene, a mass conveyor intercepted by the Hierophantical at the System Mandeville Point. Are my facts in error?
Lemuel nodded.
Yes. No, I mean, not exactly. Chaya was there with us too.
Who is Chaya?
A native of Prospero,
said Lemuel, and the Space Wolves spat at the mention of their enemy's home world.
She and Camille were lovers. She left with us. She's up in the gallery. You have to help her, please.
If you tell me what I need to know, said Nagasena. Where is Kalimakas? Was he aboard the Cypria Selene?
Yes, Mahavastu was with us on the Selene,
gasped Lemuel, his face taut with ever-increasing pain.
But I don't know what happened to him, I swear it. We were split up. They questioned us with our faces pressed to the dirt, mouths and eyes clogged with red earth. Men like him in leather masks with yellow eyes and knives of ice.
Lemuel wept uncontrollably.
They cut us into pieces, broke open our minds and ripped out every secret thought, made us scream, made us beg to die. And when they were done, they left us here in the dark. I swear by the throne I don't know what happened to Mahavastu. I never saw him in this place.
Nagasena looked into Lemuel Gaumon's pain-filled eyes, searching for deception but finding none. He took a breath and came to a decision.
If Chaya is alive, I will bring her to you.
Thank you,
whispered Lemuel, his chest racked with sobs.
And in return for your life and hers, you are going to help us find Azek Araman.
What?
Cried Lemuel, the hope in his eyes retreating.
No, please, not again. Don't take me anywhere near those monsters. I beg you, please. Kill me if you must, but please don't make me face Araman again.
Biaki grunted with impatience and knelt at Lemuel's side. He bared his fangs with a feral grin, one brow cocked. Lemuel cringed in terror from the giant wolf.
I am called Badfa Biaki, rune priest to Jarl Ogvai Ogvai Helmskrot of Tra, blood brother of Ulvarul Heorot, called Longfang, said Biaki.
Tell me, mortal, who do you fear most right now? Me? Or Azek Araman?
You.
But which of us do you hate more?
Him,
said Lemuel without pause.
And you want him dead, Jarl?
Yes.
Biaki grinned.
Good. Then it's settled. You'll tell us all you know about the Red Sorcerers and how to find them. Then you'll tell me why they risk so much to free you.
But I don't know anything.
We'll see,
said Biaki, standing and spitting again, as though just talking to Lemuel had somehow sullied him. The rune priest turned to Olgir Widdowson.
You know something of mortal flesh, he said. Make sure he doesn't die, and bring him aboard the Doromar.
I'll see it done,
said Widdowson, reaching down and all but throwing Lemuel over his shoulder. The remembrancer screamed in pain as he was carried away.
Was he telling the truth?
Asked Nagasena.
Yes. Or at least he thinks he is.
You believe his mind could have been tampered with?
It wouldn't be the first time they tried it,
said Biaki, tapping a finger to his blood-streaked forehead.
Sorcerers are tricky like that. Perhaps none who spend any time with the sons of Magnus are to be trusted.
I sincerely hope you are wrong, said Nagasena, for he is our best hope of finding the Thousand Sons.
Maybe not, said an exhausted voice behind them. Biaki snarled as he caught a familiar scent and spun on his heel, one hand reaching for his weapon, the other pistoning out before him. A pale nimbus of light wreathed his gauntlet. Nagasena followed the rune priest's lead and reached for Shijuki, but found his scabbard empty. The Volkite was gone too, but then he saw he would have no need of weapons. Diopromus dragged an unconscious warrior armored in crimson plate, whose crumpled face was a mask of blood.
His name is Menkaura.
Amon sucked in a breath of furnace-hot air. It scorched his lungs with etheric power. His eyes snapped open and he stared into the dark heart of an enormous warp storm raging over the obsidian tower. The eye of the storm seethed with power. Forking bolts of lightning exploded around him. Broken spires fell from the tower in cascades of vitrified stone. Pain surged through Amon, almost blinding him with its intensity. He screamed at the memory of nightmare claws and terrible fangs tearing his subtle body, feral warp things feasting on him in frenzied packs. Too many to fight, he'd barely escaped back to his body. He tried to rise, but couldn't move. Amon remembered the golden support throne enclosing his crippled body. After the limitless freedom he'd so recently known, immobility was a fresh terror discovered anew.
Father!
He screamed, but the storm only laughed at him. He twisted his head, seeing no sign of his Primarch. Veins bulged at his throat as he struggled to move, feeling ghosts of sensation in his limbs. How long had they been flying the great ocean? How much had his body healed in his spirit's absence? Not enough. The storm was growing bolder. Thunder boomed, echoing from towering mountain ranges that had not existed when Amon last looked from this summit. Hurricane winds battered the obsidian tower, and enormous chunks of rock fell from its sides like ice carving from a glacier. Amon forced himself into the lower enumerations, imposing calm where only disorder ruled. His body was yet ruined, but it was still his to command, if not by biological means, then by psychic ones. The wind howled with ether power, and Amon drew it into his flesh, screaming as his abused body started to come undone from the inside. He forced kind power into his bones, willing himself to stand as the obsidian tower shook itself apart. Slowly, so slowly, every millimeter upright a battle, Amon rose from the throne.
Magnus the Red!
He yelled into the storm's teeth.
Show yourself!
Each step was agony, as though his bones were made of slowly fracturing glass. He forced the pain aside and walked to the center of the swaying tower. He forced himself to kneel, placing a hand flat against its sigil-etched surface as he sought some trace of his gene-sire within. There was nothing. The obsidian tower was abandoned. Amon stood with a grunt of pain, knowing that no artis of the Pavoni could undo the damage he was doing to himself. He sent a psychic summons into the storm and limped to the tower's crumbling edges. Firestorms painted every horizon in red. The planet of the sorcerers burned in chaotic flux. Amon felt the wildness of the world slipping beyond all hope of control, its unfettered power of creation released from the dominance of intellect.
Where did you go? Said Amon.
No answer was forthcoming, but Amon could yet feel his father's presence, distant, faint, and so terribly lost.
A mind without purpose will wander in dark places, he said, as a roaring blast of turbines cut through the deafening sound of cracking stone.
Amon looked up as his stormbird swooped from the storm like the phoenix on its way to the last fire. It circled the tower once before hovering in front of Amon and lowering its assault ramp. He stepped onto the aircraft just as the obsidian tower collapsed in an avalanche of inert rock and soulless glass. It slumped into a pyramid of glittering black shards, a dark mockery of all they had lost. The Stormbird turned from the ruin of the Crimson King's Tower, and Amon swept his gaze out over the maddened world in search of the Primarch.
"I will bring you home, Father," he said.
Though the battle for Committee Sona was over, violent spasms still smouldered in its collapsing depths. Vengeful Sisters of Silence hunted packs of hooting, grunting beasts in vicious skirmishes throughout the monolithic vaults of the orbital prison. True to his word, Yasu Nagasena located a woman that matched Lemuel Gaumon's description in the upper cells. She lived, but had suffered a fractured jaw and was badly concussed. With most of the inmates dead and the captives secure, Committee Sona was being abandoned. Promus, Nagasena, and Biaki led the Imperial forces through the destruction left in the traitor Reaver's wake. They made their way back to the embarkation decks, through smashed gateways and ruined hallways of crushed stonework. Muttering wraiths lingered in the shadows, and Biaki was heard to speak words of warding against new-birthed wights of the Underverse. At length, Dio Promus led them into the upper embarkation deck, and such a scene of devastation to make even the staunchest blanch. Hundreds of torn bodies lay strewn around the wreckage of the entire deck, bronze-armored sisters, entire maniples of robots and enemy legionaries without blazons or any identifying marks on their armor. All killed, friend and foe alike, by the traitor Reaver. The god machine was on its knees, its lifeless head hung low over the molten ruin of its torso. Blue-hot fires flickered within its skull, and a rain of burning machine blood drizzled from its shattered body. An Imperial warhound lay beneath it, both its legs crushed and its plasma blast gun still lambent with the heat of a killing shot. Magus Videns and the rest of the Mechanicum contingent rushed heedless through the battlefield towards the fallen warhound, but there was nothing to be done for it. The others followed more warily, dispatching wounded enemies and checking for survivors among the sisters. One thing swiftly became clear. No thousand suns numbered among the fallen. Nor was there any sign of enemy gunships.
"Antaka Saivan destroyed the enemy vessel?" asked Promus.
"He is Ravengard," said Nagasena,
which was answer enough. Promus swore.
"Then the enemy are loose in the void, and they will try to seize a ship."
The librarian opened a voxlink to the Arethusa.
"Magus Uexkul," he said, "this is Promus. The enemy is en route to you aboard gunships. Prepare to repel boarders."
"Boarders,"
replied the master of the Arethusa.
"The void churns with E-mag distortion, but I detect no incoming craft of any description."
"They are not aboard mere gunboats,"
said a woman's voice, thick with pain. Sister Caesaria's armor was sheeted with blood from pauldrons to greaves, her breastplate split down its center and her skull gleaming red. But for Svavnir Rackwolf's supporting arm, she would not be standing.
"Do you know how they escaped?"
said Nagasena.
"They took the Osiris Panthea," said Caesaria,
coughing up a wad of bloody tissue.
"Right from under us, cargo and all."
"Osiris Panthea," said Promus. "What is that?" Caesaria gave a bitter bark of irony.
"It's a black ship,"